So I'll start presenting some of the work we've been doing recently. And so it's after the phenotypic basis of epistasis. And first, I've acknowledged some of the people who've done some of the work I will present: Hervé Jacquier, François Blancard. Hervé is in the lab now. François is joining the unit in the department now. And if we have time, I'll present some work we've been doing in collaboration with Martin Weicht and Matteo Filiuzzi. And mostly, I'll present the work of two super students: André Birgi, who's a pharmacist, and Harry Campbell, both of them are about to. André is finishing in a month. And so, we geneticists, whether we work on bacteria, yeast, fly, mice, what are we after overall when we think about it? Okay, businessmen after money, politician after power, but what are we after? We're after mutations, okay? And our goal is to unravel and discover mutation and understand their effects. That's what we're after in different ways. The thing is that we're greedy, and we may not just want one mutation, but we may want more mutations, many mutations, or eventually different backgrounds, not just one mutation, the same mutation in different backgrounds. So we're interested in those kind of features. And as soon as you're interested in two mutations or different backgrounds, we're talking about epistasis coming to the picture. So briefly, what is epistasis? So when you have one mutation and another one, and if you combine them, the best expectation you can get is that the effect would be additive, and you would add on the log fitness the effect of both mutations. And then epistasis, I like the quote from Diane Wainwright. She says, epistasis is the measure of my surprise when I measure the fitness of the double mutants and compare it to what I know from the single one. So it's like here, when epistasis is positive, here you see oh, I'm surprised. It's not what I expected, okay? And this is positive. It's higher, so it's positive epistasis if the double mutant has a higher fitness than the one we expected. And this is negative epistasis. But there's a lot of vocabulary about epistasis. Then we have here's the two single mutants and the double mutants. You can have epistasis, as I presented previously, that the effect is less than what I expected, but still both mutations are beneficial in the two backgrounds. So the mutation, this mutation is always, those two mutations are always beneficial. Or one can be beneficial in one background and deleterious in the other one, or the two, and that leads to what's called sign epistasis, when the effect of a mutation is depending on the background. But then there's another vocabulary that was introduced partly by Benjamin, Michael, and Sergei, about trying to look at a more global picture, and the word was global epistasis or macroscopic epistasis that I like better. And it's to try to see whether there's any global trend or something like this in epistasis that we can capture rather than describing that. And as I said in my previous talk, we may have some ideas that there's some global trend that we can see in two different ways. If you start many different populations that start with different genome fitness, initial fitness, and follow how fast they adapt, you find out that the least adapted they are, the faster they adapt. Which means that presumably it's not a direct proof, but there might be some effect that the effect of mutation may be different in this background. And so it was also in the Richard Lenski experiment, through time, whenever you adapt population, you find out that through time there's a decay in the rate of adaptation. It could occur for many reasons, but one of them that has been shown in some small system using handfuls of mutation is that overall the effect of mutation is decreasing. So if you take a beneficial mutation and put it in an unadapted genotype, the effect is quite large. If you put the same mutation in a more adapted genotype, the effect is lower. So that's been found consistently. And Sergei and Michael say that it could even make epistasis, even though you don't have the same mutations in a population, through that form of epistasis, the trajectory, the fitness trajectory, are kind of predictable. Okay? And so if we try to understand this epistasis at a global scale, the idea is that give us some ideas about the kind of the adaptive landscape. And so on the back of the envelope, when you look at one mutation, the adaptive landscape is fairly simple. You just have one. If you look at two, it starts to become so one. If you look at two, five mutations can be tougher. 10, maybe slightly bigger. 20, 50, 100, you have complex landscapes. Okay? And so the question we're after is that when we work at a whole genome, it's pretty difficult to know what are the real phenotypes and what are the underlying mechanisms. And so this is what we want to ask in the lab. And so what are the molecular determinants of epistasis? And Also, what are the phenotypes that may be under selection? We saw with Christian that when you adapt population to something, it's not always easy to find the phenotypes that are under selection. And so for that, our approach was to focus on very simple systems. And so to focus on epistasis within one gene or within one small operon. So the first part of the talk, I will talk about beta-lactamase. You know, I work in a medical school, and of course, we're all interested in my students, a lot of them are pharmacists or medical doctors, and their daily job is to fight and to fight against antibiotic resistance. And so we work on beta-lactamase because now E. coli is one of the big worry, and it's a big worry because it's resistant to penicillin, and not penicillin, but all the beta-lactams. And so for E. coli, you know, amoxicillin was introduced in 1960, and in 1964 in Greece, a patient called Temoneras, she had a resistant E. coli that carried a gene on a plasmid that was called TEM later on. Okay, and so later on you have different types of beta-lactam have been introduced, and all the time within 2, 3, 4 years we've seen resistance emerge in the population. And TEM has been quite important. It's a very successful enzyme because, as I said, it occurred in 1964. And nowadays if you sample E. coli in this room, okay, everyone is concerned. There's like 40% of E. coli carry that gene. It's quite a big success for a gene that occurred in 1964. Was discovered for the first time in that species, and now in 40% of E. coli have it. And this gene has also evolved, and after the introduction of modified beta-lactams and third generation ones, and you know, some resistant, different levels of resistance have emerged. So this is what the medical doctors do. This is a disc of antibiotic. You spread some bacteria and you see that some inhibition around the disc of antibiotic because the antibiotic has diffused. And when you go to the contact, it means you're resistant, and you see that these ones can turn out to be resistant afterwards. Okay, so beta-lactam and TEM have been quite important for studying evolution, and especially Dein Reinreich was one of the first to use it in a more evolutionary perspective. And what he did is he used 5 different beneficial mutations, combined them in all possible ways so that you have 32 genotypes, and measure the MIC of all these mutants. And if you plot in that kind of way, where you have here the one with no mutation, all the 5 genotypes with one mutation, one with 2, 3, 4, you can see the landscape. And you can see that some mutation eventually in some background are deleterious, while overall, you know, the combination of the 5 is the best fit. So this is a handful of mutation within an enzyme, but that already gives us the idea that there's all kind of epistasis going on. So with François Blanquart, Guillaume Machaz and Thomas Bataillon, one of our ideas was to say, okay, what kind of landscape could generate that? And we just said, okay, let's try to use one model I've been working on for a long time, Fischer geometric model, in which it's a model in which you have like basically like a single phenotypic peak, optimum combination of phenotypes that leads to the highest fitness. And the more you move away from that optimal phenotype, the lower your fitness. Very simple model. And the idea is that what we could do simply is you start from a given point, you do, for instance, 3 mutations, you select 3 beneficial mutations, and then you combine them as Dein Reinreich has done. And then you see what are the different statistics that emerge from that. And you can do that in 2 flavors. Either you take 3 independent mutations, so you adapt, you start from the single point, and 3 times you start an adaptation, and you sample those 3 mutations and combine them. Or you can do a walk of 3 mutations and then combine those mutations. Okay, and so you do that landscape. And so when we started super far from the optimum, what you observe is that there was no kind of epistasis. There was a little bit of diminishing return epistasis because the landscape is shaped the way the landscape, the fitness curvature is shaped, but nothing fun emerged. But when we're closer and we look at some statistics of the landscape that emerged, for instance, the fraction of sign epistasis that is in the landscape, or the roughness to slope, these are different statistics, I'm not going to go too much into the detail. We saw that according to the number of dimensions we use in that model, or, you know, starting from the same exact condition, you could have a zoo of different landscapes. So meaning that you have a very simple phenotypic landscape, you start from a single point, and you do different walks, you sample different sets of mutation from that same point, and you can get very different landscapes. And so for instance here, in the case of independently selected mutation, okay, you can have a scenario where, you know, these are the mutations, you selected 5 different mutations, you combine them, this is the landscape you have. Or you've selected 5 others, and this is the landscape you have. Here, if you take a random walk also, you can have a landscape that has almost no sign epistasis and one that shows a lot. And so we saw that, you know, it means what it means, and this kind of different landscape have been observed by the group of Argent de Visser, in which they sampled different types of beneficial mutation in beta-lactam-astame, and they found out that, you know, according to those landscapes, you have very different, according to the subset of mutation you take, you build up very different landscapes. So the idea to us was that, okay, just so looking at a subset of mutation is interesting, but it may be difficult to know the underlying picture, because even then, when we tried to fit the model, it was really loose. We couldn't get any of the parameters of the model. So it means that a very simple model can produce a very large diversity of landscape. And so it's hard to get any information from it in the end, because initially when we started, the idea was like, oh yeah, we're going to be able to say just from this little landscape to get some information of the underlying picture and move forward like this and compare all these landscapes. But then when you find that a global kind of boring landscape, just like Fisher geometric model, is it can produce such a large diversity, you're a bit frustrated. So the idea is that we wanted to move forward and not just to look at a handful, but to look at a more global scale. And also, you know, you have this nothing makes sense slide, you know, when nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution, adoption scene, and nothing makes sense in evolution except in the light of population genetics, Mike Lynch, and nothing makes sense in population genetics except in the light of system biology. So we wanted to go more to the mechanism and try to see what's going on. And when you look at the protein, what's known, and thanks to amazing work by Jessim Bloom during his PhD, there's like most of the amino acids involved in the structure of a protein are involved in maintaining the structure rather than being involved in the active site. And it means that the impact of mutation on those residues could be mostly affecting stability of the protein rather than the active site. And so they initially showed that by taking two different genotypes, TEM1 wild type and TEM1 with one stabilizing mutation, and they accumulated mutations, so they did random mutagenesis in them, and look at how many mutants would survive. And you could see that in the wild type, the survival rate was much lower than in the stabilized genotype. So that was an idea that stability may matter. And so with Hervé Jacquier, what we did is that we did 1,000 mutant within beta-lactam-astame-1, so it was not, at that time, it was not at all next-generation sequencing, but was thanks to next-generation sequencing, because we produced 10,000 mutants, and we sequenced them all just because the Sanger sequencer were free, because nobody was using them anymore, so that's how we could get access to this material. And then from that, we had about a good coverage, we could cover about 60% of the single amino acid change that you could do in the enzyme. And what Hervé did, the massive amount of work, he measured for each of them in replicate the minimum inhibitory concentration of all those mutants. And you can see, of course, as usual, minimum inhibitory concentration is the concentration at which you don't observe any more growth. And the wild type will have this distribution. You see it's a quite noisy measurement, but still you can see that you have the distribution of mutants is overrepresented in deleterious mutant, and a large fraction of them tend to inactivate the enzyme. So we've done quite a bit of analysis on those mutants, but one of the results is that we did the same thing, Hervé did the same thing in this stabilizing mutant, and you can see that this distribution shifted quite drastically. This is the distribution that I just presented you in TEM1, and this one is in the stabilized mutant, where you see that much less mutant have an effect in that background, okay? You move towards neutrality, which makes sense. So if you plot like stability, you know that stability is a nonlinear process, and so normally it's the other way around, but I'm a biologist, I prefer that way. Okay, and so if you have an increased stability on the right-hand side, okay, yeah, you have this kind of curvature that is nonlinear, and if you stay here and produce mutants, you have quite a large variance in fitness in the observed, but if you move toward a more stable genotype, you have a much lower variance in fitness. So that's what we had just observed. But now we wanted to go further in that. And for that, what we did is that with André, we started not to just measure MIC, but to do fitness assay, and want to look at epistasis at large scale in one fraction of beta-lactamase. So we took one alpha helix of 11 amino acids, and we did all possible double mutants in there. So there should be like 22,000 double mutants, but we got about 15,000 with accurate fitness estimates. Okay? So the idea of why taking an alpha helix, because it's one of the most common structures, secondary structure in proteins. And then also, we didn't want it to do anything with the active site. We just wanted to do, let's take one random bit. That was the only one that was the proper size. In the end, it's not that far to the active site, but none of them has been described as being part of the active site in any way. So then what we did is that we evolved them. So we first grow the cells without antibiotic, then we dilute them with antibiotic, and then as soon as they reach an OD of O2, we dilute them, so every 2-3 hours for 2 days, people stay in the lab and sleep overnight in the lab to do that, and then we get the DNA out and sequence. These are barcoded, so the genotypes are barcoded, and so then from the different time points, if you have the log, you do the ratio of mutant to wild type, through time, the slope is the log fitness, okay? And because we have different barcodes, with a single experiment, we can estimate the amount of noise we have in the data. We can lose half of the barcode or the other half and compare what the estimates we would have. And you can see that it's fairly good on the range of the correlations 0.99 between the two parts of the estimates. So what we can first do is to look at, among all these 11 amino acids, the single mutant effects. And this mutation towards like the different amino acids. And so you can see that basically we have like a good control first is that, this is proline. We know that proline is forbidden in alpha helix because it's changing the structure. And so that's a good control. Red meaning deleterious. All mutation to proline inactivate the enzyme. And then there's some sites that are more permissive to mutation than others, but we have a lot of inactivating mutations. So now we can look at the double mutants. Gray means missing data. And you can see, what you can see is that, okay, we have a lot of red in here. And basically we have a domination of, a dominance of inactivating mutation, which means that whenever I combine, two sites that are mostly, that are very constrained, which means most mutations are deleterious, the rule is red against red gives red, okay? If you combine two highly inactivating mutation, almost 100% of the case, you got an inactivating mutation. If you combine yellow with yellow, like neutral with neutral, you see some effect a little bit, and that's where we're gonna see, eventually capture some forms of epistasis. So to plot that here, what we have here is the predicted fitness of the W mutant, if you add the effect of the single mutant, okay, that's what you would predict. And here's the observed one. And so all this cloud is, and what is in blue is the mutants for which I cannot estimate epistasis, because I estimated that below fitness of -1, I had a distribution of stop codons that would give me the lower bound for which I could estimate when is the gene inactivated. And I estimated that below -1, I cannot say much about this fitness. It means that the clone is dead. Okay. And so if I predict that a combination of mutation inactivate the gene, and that I found that the double mutant is inactive, I cannot say anything about epistasis, okay? I have no clue about whether it's more or less, I have no information on epistasis. But on all the other points, I may have some information of epistasis. What's striking is that those may have a little bit of noise, but when you combine in this part, when you combine the deleterious mutant, basically this space is empty, because there's like 12,000 mutants here, and you may have one or two that show sign, but there may eventually be noise. But still, when we look at those, the other ones, what we find is that we have a large distribution of epistasis and with slightly more deleterious epistasis, negative epistasis.
Can you go back to the last slide a second?
Sorry?
Can you go back to the last slide? What do you mean by noise? I mean, those are good measurements.
These are good measurements. I mean, the thing is that here it's a slide I've done a few weeks ago, and some of the measurements are good, but when you go in the deleterious one, you may have a bit of noise. You have more noise in the deleterious part, and so for some of them I have to recheck, so I haven't checked carefully those ones.
But you don't mean that they're noise in the sense that just because there's few of them, like in a statistical sense?
No, not in a statistical sense. I mean that the measurements I have to recheck. I wouldn't bet my hand on any of those.
Dot.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Okay. So that's on the other one I can be sure, but on those few ones I have to recheck whether, because there's one or two mutants on which I have more noise than expected, so I have to filter them out. So it's like a. And so here that's the distribution. And okay, great. I mean, but any system with noise would produce a distribution that is centered on zero. So you always worry when you produce those large data sets, like, ooh, what's real and what's not. And so then I started to trust the data when I look at individual sites. And so let me drive you through this picture. So here, for every single mutation, I have it alone in the wild-type ancestor with a very accurate estimate. And then I have it combined with eventually 100 different backgrounds. And I can compute, because I know also the fitness of these 100 backgrounds, and can compute the fitness of that mutation in those backgrounds by looking at the fitness of the double mutants and subtracting the one of the other mutation. And this is what I'm plotting here. Here would be the background, so the fitness of the second mutation. And here the fitness of my mutation, for example, S6R here in that, across the different backgrounds. In blue, it means that I'm below my minus one fitness. It means I'm in the lethal zone. So those mutants are inactivated. I cannot say much. In gray here, it means that I predict that the first mutation is inactivating, and the other one is recovering a fitness that I can compute as not dead. But, you know, measuring, you know, your fitness compared to a dead one is I mean, I said there might be some issue here. So. But in here, I can measure. And here is one mutant where you see that across all background, there's a bit of noise, but you can see that there's no much of a trend. Okay. But this is not. This is almost the exception, because, I mean, first, we have about 67 sites are unconditionally lethal. You know, all the backgrounds, they inactivate the function. So they're just boring sites where whatever happens, you don't recover anything, and they always inactivate the function. But then those ones, I only have 15 of those out of 209, and most of the others are of that type. Okay, they would be show a slope that is negative or some intermediate slope, but the negative slope here. And 10 of them are like this, show this pattern. Okay, where you see that they can have barely almost no effect in that background, but up to 50% beneficial effect in other backgrounds. And so overall, what we see, so unconditionally lethal would be about that fraction. Deleterious with context dependency would be that. Context independent, well, we think that most mutations should not have epistatic interaction. Here we find, you know, it's just only a few of them. And I'll come back to that. And almost out of those ones, there's like, I think, 12 out of the 15 or something like this have about zero fitness estimate. So they're just neutral, almost. And three of them has 2, 3, and 1, 10%. We'll come back to that. And then a handful of them also, slightly more, can
What's
be...
the axis label on top?
The what?
The axis label.
So that's the number of mutants.
Number.
Yeah, absolute number on 209 different mutations. Okay. So then we can come back to this stability model. And so what we can assume is that, as we did in the previous part, that fitness can be linked actually to the fraction of folded protein, which is just based on this function. If you make a two-state folding probability. So if you either folded or unfolded according to your free energy, you can compute the fraction that will be in the folded state. And then you can just assume that, you know, relative fitness is based on the ratio to the wild type, and on the log it gives that function. And then we can try to play, what if we have now this type of fitness function, what happens if we have a mutant that has a delta delta G of, you know, a given value, and that is combined with other mutants that have a different set of delta delta G. And this is what the kind of, if we have a highly destabilizing mutation, so delta delta G is positive, then we have this kind of graph. That's what we expect. Then if it's less, then if it's zero, we have a flat line. And if it's positive, if it's a stabilizing mutation, we have that. So qualitatively, we see that the model predicts this kind of pattern that we observed. Okay. And when we can fit, then we can fit and try to estimate for all the single mutants the stabilizing effect. We find that we got a very good fit with the data, in the sense, I mean, whatever correlation can be up to 97.5% or something like this with the data. So we can get, yeah.
Sorry, for the top left, you fit only part of the data?
Sorry?
The top left panel, you fit only part of the data? Because your line only...
So yeah, I mean, it's fitting because those ones, actually, they're also fitted by the data because they're just estimated. I take into account the fact that when you below a given threshold, the fitness is set to the minimum value. So those ones are plotting the real value, but in some sense, those ones are just set to the minimum value. So they're taken into account too. but they say that they're in the threshold where they, everything below here would be a fitness that is, you know.
Okay. After you've made some predictions about the delta G, have you ever gone back and tried to do a measurement, or has anybody measured the?
So we're not expert for those. I mean, we've tried in the past to get some of these. It's been a nightmare. Hervé Jacquet did a postdoc in a biochemistry lab to try to do that, but every single mutant had different. We tried to crystallize to produce some of the mutants, but every single one was a nightmare. As soon as they destabilized, it's a nightmare to purify them because they aggregate with many things, so you can never get pure protein. So it's just been a disaster. We tried that. So for those ones, so far, I mean, it's a month ago, so we haven't started that. But at least one of them has been described in the literature as being a stabilizing mutation. So among those ones, ideally we would have to go, but I'm afraid that we're not good at that job, and I'm still a bit reluctant to go in that direction because it was really costly last time we did it. Okay.
Can you find like the S6EB1GWB specifically? I mean, you could try the double mutant of these two on the left, for instance.
Yeah, we could try. We have done that in the past also. With double mutants, you could get and see whether you restore and stuff. But ideally, we would go there. But, you know, we're a small lab, too. So we could get some fairly good fit. But then still, there's some outliers. And what I'm trying to work on now is that there's some situations that do not fit the picture. And here's one of them, where you see that this mutant, overall, you find a decay. But here, you also have quite straight line that appears on top. And so what's going on? Is it up and down? And then you look more carefully, and all those mutants, double mutants, occur at the next site. So it's not random. All these one occur at the next site. And D, this is positively charged, and you move to a negative charge. And the next site has a negative charge, and all the mutants that you compensate here are the one where you move those ones, this negative charge on the next site, to a positive charge. So it's like you have a charge conservation going on in that site that may explain this different pattern. When it's stabilizing, it's destabilizing, slightly destabilizing, but when you conserve the charge, you have a beneficial effect and you compensate if you go the other way around. So, yep.
So next site is neighbor in 3D.
The neighbor site, yeah.
On the primary chain or in 3D?
On the primary chain, okay. And eventually one that is here, I think, is also in the 3D. But it's less clear. One is on the 3D, and it's going to a polar site, so it's less clear about the charge. But for the next one, it's really clear. I mean, all those ones, except maybe, I mean, one here that is also slightly significant also, maybe just on the chain when you go back to that one. So, yeah, we have this stuff where there may be also conservation of charge that may be involved. And then there's another one that, you know, this one, if you try to fit a model, you see that the fitting is really out, because this one is unconditionally slightly deleterious, okay? And so this one doesn't fit at all, so the cost that we hear cannot be due to destabilizing effect, okay? It's due to something else, and actually, that's the site that is the closest to the active site, okay? That's the only one where some of the neighboring sites have been shown to be essential for the function of the active site, so eventually that one. And here again, it would be good to do some assays clearly, but that one may be more having an effect. But this is my worry would be that, you know, this is a 10% difference in fitness, which means that if we were to do any biochemistry, I doubt we would be able to measure it that well, because a 10% in fitness, in terms of the roughness of the biochemistry estimates, tend to be not that precise and so on. But I mean, we could eventually think that there's like two different ways of doing that. So to conclude on that part, and I'm fast, when we look at the structural part of a protein, okay, what we found out is that we have pervasive epistasis that is linked to stability, because, you know, either we don't have epistasis when the sites are unconditionally lethal, okay, but then the sites that show no sign of context dependency, no sign of kind of macroscopic epistasis, are just a handful, and apart from three, all the others were neutral. There were no effect predicted on stability, so they also fit the model. And then what this also suggests, that a model with additivity at the phenotypic level, because that's what we assume in the model, that we just add the delta G's of the mutants, is matching really well. Nevertheless, when we do the fitting, because we found that some local interaction may play a role, I also did some of the fitting, excluding the local sites in the 3D structure, excluding and just looking at the distant ones, and I got a much better fit. And then I can try to explore. So now I'm in that game of trying to find out how can I exclude the sites that do not play, that could, because when you do a fitting, those sites may influence the quality of the fit you have, change the slope. So now I try to look at a distance to extrapolate the delta, delta G, and try to extract the important information, the residual that may be relevant. And we see that it may come from different reasons. It may be a departure from additivity. For instance, when you have two sites, when they are distant, it could just be additive at the phenotypic level. But eventually, when they're close by, this additivity may not work and may result in more complex interaction and 3D, I don't know how. Or other phenotype may be involved, for instance, the charge, the conservation of charge at some place, maybe. And also, we found out that even though we have one global phenotype that is under selection when we look at the structure, there may be another completely independent one, for instance, linked to the active site, like in this mutation that is more linked close to the active site and may not at all affect stability, but just be involved in some of the active site. Yeah, Richard?
So have you compared these sort of stasis coefficients with covariation signatures?
So I work with Martin Weicht, okay? So we've been trying a lot of that, and we've been a bit disappointed by the quality of the prediction we have so far so I can, in the end, because I'm going fast, we may have time, I'll come back to what we've been doing, and you can remind me if I forget about that, yeah.
But I'm a bit confused. Again, could you explain why do you see that additivity at the phenotypic level is dominating?
Because when the pattern we have here, maybe I haven't said it, but whenever we do those fitting, okay, here we just assume that to predict the effect, here we just add the delta delta G of the mutants, and through the epistasis not coming out from the specificity of an interaction, it's just you are fully additive.
The phenotype is the stability, yeah. Not the fitness.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
And so here also it's interesting because we have a decoupling, then a semantic decoupling from epistasis. Usually in genetics, you know, epistasis means interaction, okay? But in population genetics, it means interaction that translates in non-additivity in log fitness. But here we come out to this point where we have two mutations that do not interact somehow directly because it's additive on the phenotypic level, but it does translate in non-additivity because the function is non-linear. The genotype to fitness, the fitness phenotype to fitness is non-linear, and so you have this decoupling where you say, oh, those two mutations, okay, they you see some epistatic interaction. And what would be the reflex of most people in any paper whenever they look at two mutations that interact in epistatic interaction? They plot another 3D structure and look whether they talk to one another. But here we find out that, you know, it may not, you don't need at all them to talk and to be close to one another and to build a so-so story about, oh, this one is doing it. I'm not able to do that. That's why I criticize it. But, you know, where they always, whenever people look at epistasis within a protein, they always focus on those key lock interaction and so on. While here we show that just going through stability may explain most of it. Okay? So this was one, so this is undergoing work. And another project we're doing, and a shift to white, that's done by an amazing PhD student, Harry Campbell, is that we wanted to look, okay, here we can look within a protein, but okay, protein are not always independent, and here we have a simple phenotype that is antibiotic stability, resistant to antibiotic and survival to antibiotic. But then we are also interested in trying to figure out what's going on if we look at metabolic genes in a metabolic pathway, okay? And the idea, rather this time than playing on the enzyme and protein and mutation within, let's look at the regulation of those. And so we focus on metabolic pathway because when you look in E. coli genome, you know about 676 genes out of the 4,000 are predicted to be enzymes involved in the metabolism. Okay, this is the metabolic map. And so if you look in the old literature, there's been, you know, discussion about what are the phenotypes that are selected for in a metabolic pathway. And going back to the 80s, it was proposed that what matters is the flux. So people, Dan Dacquitzen, Tony Dean, and Dan Hardell, they proposed that using metabolic control theory, you can predict the flux going through a pathway according to the enzyme level. Okay, and they predicted that using the LAC operon as a model, they predict that you should reach this plateau at some point where everything's becoming neutral because you saturate the enzyme level, and there's no effect anymore. But then in the 2000, Yuri Allen, and later on, more convincingly in other papers, people have shown this kind of effect, that eventually this is not just a plateau in the end, because there may be some cost due to expression. If you overproduce something, you may have a cost, and so you may have, in the end, something that would decay, and you would eventually here see the plateau. It's not the plateau, it's going down at some point. It's been shown in some, the system, in the nicest work, I think, is made by Chu and Marx, in which they show that they had a plasmid system that was really high, overproduced, and then they show that they selected for mutation that would limit that overproduction, either by decreasing the plasmid copy number or by changing the promoter intensity. And so it was very elegant work. Then Michael Lasish also, in a very nice paper, showed also that toxicity could be involved, even in the lac operon. And he said that eventually some of the previous work that said, oh, it's a cost expression cost that we're seeing, was actually due to some toxicity. Here in the lactose operon is due to the permease. LacY is pumping protons when IPTG is coming in, and so you acidify your cell, and it's becoming toxic. Okay, and he showed that this build up in some non-linearity, and there was some toxicity. So we wanted to try a simple system. Initially, we started from other purposes linked to Fisher models, but that's how we came to here. And we focus on one of the most characterized, not the lactose operon. Okay, we give that to other people, but to the arabinose pathway. And the arabinose, you take L-arabinose, RA will transform in L-ribulose, then RAB will transform in L-arabulose 5-phosphate, and then with pentose phosphate pathway, and then that will lead to growth. Interestingly, what we're interested in initially is that those two genes are in the same operon, and they're always co-expressed. And we wanted to decouple the expression of the two to see whether, you know, what's going on if we decouple the expression of those two, to see in terms of the dimensionality of the space and so on. One thing that we noticed through all literature from the 70s is that this is a toxic compound. And actually, all phosphates, you know, phosphated sugars tend to be toxic. And if you look here, all the black dots are some phosphate and are toxic. And so this is not something that is, you know, the exception. It's fairly common that you have some intermediate that have toxicity in a metabolic pathway. So what the model we have, I'm going to present that in a short way somehow, is that we have two selection for growth and selection to avoid the toxic to accumulate the toxic compound. And so going back to old papers also, Urs Zapmari, based on previous work by Andy Clark, proposed that we could have a model in which we have both selection for those two phenotypes somehow to select for growth and avoid this compound that could result in this kind of landscape. If you have two enzymes, two genes upstream of a metabolite that is toxic and that is required for growth, you would get a stabilizing selection on that. So the idea is that you have, first you can see, compute the amount of that product that will be produced through the pathway. And so from a metabolic control theory, this is based on the expression of the two genes. And then you can say that this is under stabilizing selection. There's an optimum concentration of that product that you need, and that would lead to that landscape. If there was not, you would have this, the landscape would be like the one that Dan Dykhuizen and Antonin Jin found. But here now, if you go to too high of the intermediate, you have it's deleterious, so you have this valley. So you have this weird banana-shaped landscape. Okay. And so we wanted to see whether this is relevant in our system. And so what Harry did is that he constructed the strain in which we have RA and RB. And initially, we just wanted to play on the promoter, but he had the idea to put them under inducible promoter so that we could sample the landscape just phenotypically initially by just putting different concentration of the inducers. And so basically, this is where the TET repressor is binding, and this is the ribosome binding site, okay, that we're going to mutagenize later. Okay, so and for the initially, what he would do is we would just measure growth rate with different concentration of the inducers and try to see how the landscape is. So we put some arabinose in the media, a bit of cas amino acid, and we look according to the concentration of the inducer. So it would be higher concentration of RAB along that axis, higher concentration of RA along that axis. And this is the growth rate that the landscape could built using growth rates.
And you have a known relationship between inducer concentration and enzyme expression?
Not fully. So the trouble we find now he's trying to do is at ESPCI, there were many people from ESPCI, we're trying to do in microfluidic droplet to quantify that properly. For now, it's qualitative. And we're trying to go to the phenotype and to measure that in a... But so far, and because what you cannot use, every construct is slightly different. We're going to plasmid here. And so if you go to papers where it's on the chromosome or on a different plasmid and you have the repressor is here or on the chromosome, everything does change. So we're not, so we will be qualitative. What we notice is that the cost of expression here is just in the absence of an arabinose. So we could see that if there was a cost of expression, we could measure it. Eventually, there's a little bent in the end here, but it doesn't seem to be massive, okay, compared to what we see here. And so presumably a lot of it, yeah, sorry?
But also shouldn't it be, so if that really is a cost of expression, shouldn't it be symmetric for the two genes?
It could also be, it should also be, yeah, but maybe one is overproduced slightly more. You also have some leakiness.
It does make in the RNA.
No, I agree.
The protein itself.
But maybe you have some more leakiness in the stuff. But yeah, I agree, it should be. So far we can say that, you know, expression, the cost of expression doesn't seem to fit the picture mostly. And presumably it's really toxicity that is playing a role.
Yeah.
Okay? So then what Harry did is that thanks to the method that André developed to produce those mutants, we also haven't come to the detail to produce those mutants at high throughput. He did the same, and this time we mutagenized just the ribosome, the RNA polymerase binding site. And so for each of them, we just mutagenize, okay, those 12 sites. Okay, so 12 sites mean there's like 36 single mutants here, 36 here, but we also do all possible combination with one mutation here and one mutation here. Okay, so this is what we have, and so presumably the repressor binding should not be affected too much by the site. Eventually, there's one base that is, you know, kind of connected. But overall, we could say that it's independent. So he's done that, and so the idea is that we picked a point to see, he chose a concentration of inducer, and we did this mutagenesis in order to explore the neighborhood. How would we go? And then, of course, then, you know, it's the same thing. You spend a few days in the lab, a few nights in the lab, where you evolve the strains, dilute them regularly in the media, and sample the strains and sequence and barcode and so on. So this is the kind of overall frequency of all the mutants. And so here's the landscape. So here's just for the PLAC, so the promoter of RAB, here's the promoter of RA, because they have the same sequence. You can see all the single mutants effects on here, and all the double ones here. And here's the color, and what first strikes us is that almost all the mutants are beneficial, which is not what you expect usually when you do, you know, distribution of mutants. You expect always like, but it does make sense if you think that, you know, let's assume like, that we have like an optimum Fisher model-like model, okay, where you have the optimal combination of something. And if you start from here, okay, selection is for reducing expression. But our promoters, the promoters we use, are highly optimized promoters, meaning that they really, they are hard to improve, and so most of the mutation bring them down, okay? And so it means that's the kind of picture we have, where most of the mutation, and the two only exceptions that are deleterious, are actually mutations that move towards the consensus RNA polymerase binding site, meaning the mutations that are known to increase further the expression level are deleterious in that background, which really means that it's selected to decrease, the selection is acting to decrease the expression in the system on those genes. Okay?
So have you tested them in another, with the other concentrations that would basically...
We'll come back to that. So then, then we were interested in epistasis. And there's many, many ways to present that, but I'm going to present with that. So it's a nice picture that, kind of confusing though, that Harry did. So basically here we sort every mutant according to its fitness, every single mutant on the RAB according to its fitness. So here you just have one that is really high, so it takes a large fraction. But here you have many that are in the 5 to 10%, so each band represents one mutant. And here you do the same, and you measure with color the epistasis, the fitness of the double mutants. Okay? And first, if you look here, that if there was no epistasis, that's the picture we should expect. Okay? Something that is symmetrical in terms of color. So here what we see is that there's a strong asymmetry, and one gene is having, there's one gene is, you have this plateau on one hand axis and not on the other one. And the second thing that is striking in that is that we have here also some genotypes that have exactly the same fitness on one axis, but when combined with other mutation have very different responses. And so one possibility for that is that let's assume that here, you mutate, you know, your distribution of mutation is like this. And if you move here, you have the same fitness. But now, your mutations are completely different. So even though you have the same fitness in those two backgrounds, when you produce mutants along that axis, for instance, okay, then you would find or that axis mostly. Here you find that mutation beneficial, while here you find that they're deleterious. Okay. So overall, what we did is that we try to fit that model. So there's few parameters in that model where we have the optimal stability, the optimal compound, the different scaling parameters. And what we found out is that this landscape is really compatible with what we observe, meaning that here it looks like our ancestor is at that point in the landscape. And some mutations drive you to the other side of that peak. And when you're on the other side, the expression for RRB has no impact. Okay, you're almost neutral on RRB. Well, on that side, there's a positive slope, which means that you change side. And so this really, we try to fit other models like Fisher model that I liked. We initially started with Fisher model. It doesn't fit at all. We could not get anything working. But in that landscape, we find that we're really here. Then the next question, as Christian proposed, is that, okay, but we started in one point. Is it consistent if we start from another point in the landscape? And so that's what Harry did afterwards. We did one replicate. But let's say replication is always tough because you have inducible concentration that may always be slightly different, okay, but still. And then we do two other points in the landscape, and this is the kind of picture we have. So if in the replicate we find a slightly the same picture, but eventually slightly higher effect, so which means that we're not presumably exactly the same in the same point in the landscape, but it's overall very similar. Well, here it's when we're here, in the second environment, we find something that is consistent with being here, which means that now, this time, you have an inversion. The mutation that were deleterious previously, now they're becoming beneficial. So if you improve expression on that axis, you increase fitness, but not on the other axis because it's almost flat. And here we have something here also where we can move on both sides. Okay, so we have something that is really consistent with that landscape. Now it's also ongoing work. And so now we're trying to see how good we are about the fitting and trying to find the position of each. For now, it's just qualitative fitting, but we're trying to do some quantitative fitting to see that. So to finish on that part, so a phenotypic landscape in which we include toxicity does fit the picture quite well. Okay, and I'll go to that one. It leads to some very complex pattern of mutation effect and epistatic interaction that completely depend where you are in this landscape. Because you can find, just at the basic effect of mutation, in one case they're all beneficial almost, in the other case they're all deleterious. Well, they are the same mutations, okay? Then you have some possibility for cryptic variation because we see that just, you know, two mutants that have exactly the same fitness can lead to very different response when combined to other mutations. And one other thing, going back to Fisher geometric model, is what it's been said that, you know, whenever you have many dimensions and you want to optimize, okay, it's really difficult if you have many dimensions because you need to move, you know, and find that direction, okay, which is tricky. The more dimension you have, it's tricky. But if you're in one pathway like this, even if you have many enzymes, you find out that if you in that space, moving just one direction is always beneficial. So whatever happens, you know, you just need to reduce the expression of one of the enzyme, and the pathway is going to, in fitness, going to increase drastically. Okay, and you may say, oh, but initially our goal, we have in mind always when you think about the pathway that we're always starting from something that is completely, you know, underexpressed or something like this. But there's no reason when you change environment that you could not be in a space where you're highly expressed. And if you're here, it's really easy to adapt. So there's no cost of complexity of having 10 genes involved in this pathway or just one. Just make it easy. You can just decrease one of them, and you go to an optimum fitness. Okay? And so that was fast. Yeah.
To me, this all makes a lot of sense in the context of a linear. If I'm understanding correctly, you have a linear pathway, and so essentially you have a system where one or the other enzyme is limiting, and so this is what you get.
Yes.
So you agree with that, basically.
Yeah.
So have you explored or thought about exploring, other kinds of systems where you've got, say, a system where you have two pathways that have to both be complete in order to,
So here what we've done already in that system is that we have, one compound, the other one, and the third one, and this is RA and RB. And we started to do is that we derive some other pathway. Normally, they are always coupled, so their expression is always coupled. But because this compound is always derived from that one, but we used another pathway that could go through here, okay? And so now we can have a system in which the two are not coupled anymore. And when you could have the expression of that one should be higher than the expression of that one. And so the strain actually we used for that was the initial design, was to look at these two, compare those two regime. We can go further eventually, but for now it was the idea. So we have some data in one environment like this where you use another compound, but we started with that.
Is there a sort of generic kind of pathway that will give you diminishing returns?
Going back to the global macroscopic epistasis at the whole. I'm not sure yet. So the idea, I'm not sure. I mean, for now, as I say, we go small scale. I mean, the idea was to go, and eventually we'll build up. But I mean, we tried with FBA at some point to see whether they were. So far we're not very successful with that. But yeah, let's say, prospective future work, maybe we'll go to higher. But for now, we just started with that. Yeah. So, for those part. This is the people that did the work, and now that they see that I have time, I can come back to some of the comment and work we've been doing with Martin and Matteo, who did here, that did most of the job. Okay, so here, the idea is that after we reproduce that paper in which we measure the effect of mutants in beta-lactamase, I gave a talk, and Martin came to see me afterward, and he said, we should do something together because I have some ways to estimate mutation effect. And so what Martin has been working with Thierry Roy, who was here initially, he started with Thierry, is that he started to work on protein alignment to try to predict mutation effect. And when you have a protein alignment like this, okay, that you can use from PFAM, you can look at one site and say, for instance, at that site, you can wonder, what are the mutations that are tolerated? Okay, and you take benefit of billions of years of evolution, okay? Because you look at bacteria, eukaryotes, all possible protein that will align to that one. You look, and if you find a tryptophan at that site, and if you mutate to a tryptophan at that site, and never in the history of life there was a tryptophan at that site, you say, it's very unlikely that this is cool. Okay, it's presumably a very delicious mutation that has been filtered out by natural selection all the time. And so this has been used for years, with programs like SIFT and Polyphen, and mostly all the human genetics is using those softwares that whenever you have a candidate mutation, you run through one of those softwares and say, this is a potential cost that there is, and so all population nature genetics will use one of those softwares. But what Martin has been doing is to look at covariation between sites, and try to look whether there's some context dependency on that. I'm not the guy from statistical physics, and there's less and less in the room, so that's okay. And so he did the job and trying, because of course now you have to assume that for every mutation, there's not only a single impact on the site, there's also combination with all the sites, the number of parameters going crazy. And so because the number of pairwise interaction possible is really large, and so all the job is to try to find ways to sort out the ones that are important, and that's the job of Martin through his method called direct coupling analyzing. And this method is highly used in to detect secondary structure, I mean tertiary structure in proteins. So whenever you want, it's really used by people doing structure. They use those covariation to have some ideas about those sites interact together in close contact, okay? And it's been very successful, and there's like a lot of people working on that now. But then he said that we could also use that method to try to predict the mutation effect, not only taking into account this site, but taking it also into account the background. And so when he did the stuff on our data set, so if you use this data set, but also others, what you find out is that if you use the independent site model and try to predict the effect of mutation that are observed in this kind of experiment that we did and that others have done, many others group have been doing mutation and whole mutational scan. And in all of them, what you find that the independent model is always worse than the direct coupling analysis. So taking into account the context does improve the fit. Okay, so interestingly, just initially in our first paper, we used different stuff to estimate to predict the mutation effect. We predicted that the type of change as predicted by Blossom 62 was predicted of some fraction of the variance, whether this residue was inside or outside predicted whether mutation would be. Then we did prediction of mutation effect on stability with different softwares. Then we tried for, like, with Matteo, and we tried for a year or so on massive computers to predict the effect of those mutants through dynamic modeling and so on. It's been a disaster because it was not much better than that while we used like years and decades of computer time, and the fit was not any better than just basic softwares that you can run within a day or two. So that's been very frustrating, that part. And then, but then you see that the DCA was better than other software that do not take, you know, SIFT is very similar. But even PolyFen2, that is really the gold standard in human genetics, that everybody's using that, that's taking into account the single site model, but also taking into account structural information, okay? And so now Martin's trying to improve that eventually to take also some further information. So what was interesting is that with that model, you can look at, this would be the independent site where you try to predict the effect just based on one residue. But then you can take a ball in the 3D structure and extend it to see, you know, how far do those interactions matter, okay? So here, you can look at the sites in the alignment that are not necessarily on the primary alignment connected, but that are connected in 3D structure, and you look, okay, if I look at the context dependency, taking into account those sites that are, you know, less given angstrom away, okay, how better is my fit? Okay, you can do that and keep going like this. And what you see here would be the prediction of the data based on individual sites. And here, the further away you go, here's direct contacts. So you look at just the site, but also the one that are in direct contact. But you can see that you keep improving up to about, you know, 20 angstrom, which is basically 50% of the protein, which means that it's not just very local interaction that do matter. There's a whole background that seem to matter. Okay, so we've been working on that with Martin, and another stuff that I've been working on then is the question is, can we apply it genome-wide now? And so with Christoph Feinauer, he made predictions on all possible enzymes within E. coli for which we have in a large enough PFAM alignment. And so what we can do is that we can also compare. So we took PFAM and excluded E. coli from the alignment because otherwise it's too close. You know, there's some circularity if we use E. coli to predict what's the mutation in E. coli, so we excluded it. And then what we can look is that we can compare the independent model and the DCA in terms of optimality of the amino acid. So you look at an amino acid and you look how much of the variation, how much of the other amino acid perform better at that site, are predicted to perform better. And so when you use the DCA, you found that about 80 or about 95% of the, when you combine the first, are predicted to be the best or second to best amino acid at that site. Okay, and this is different statistics predicting that.
Sorry, just that I understand it. So you basically want to use the other species, but E. coli to predict what you actually find.
Exactly. In E. coli. Okay, so here using, exactly, that's what we're using. So first we're looking at what's the residue in E. coli, is it optimal or not? That's the first thing. Okay, and what we found out is that, okay, the model with DCA, even though we took out E. coli, is predicting that, you know, a lot of the amino acid present in E. coli are supposed to be some of the best one. Okay? That's the first, yep.
Do you have any sense how that changes as you increase the relatives of E. coli that you exclude from your model?
Usually...
Just taking out exactly your E. coli?
No, we took all the E. coli's and within I mean, maybe 16% divergence or something like this.
From 16 to 20.
No, we haven't played that game so far. But what we've done is that what we looked then is that we did, we look at, you know, when we took two strains of E. coli and look at all the mutation that occurred with between those two. And then we looked in mutation accumulation, or it's a long story in Richard Lenski's mutator lineages, and we look at the distribution of, you know, the score. So here's Martin's a physicist, so the score is like, you know, this is positive, going to the left is better when you have a delta delta G, a negative one is better, and a positive one is bad, okay, that's the score. And this is if we use mutation accumulation experiments.
What is red and blue?
I'm gonna tell you, so hold on. So first we use mutation accumulation experiments, okay, that's gonna be the bottom line. Mutation accumulation experiment are experiments in which you start, you know, every day you streak a colony, and you gotta have random colonies, and then you pick randomly one, and you cycle it to the next day to do the same thing. Okay, so it's experiments in which the population is going to single cell bottleneck every day, and that's one way that many have used to decrease the effect of natural selection and to just see mutation effects. Okay, and several experiments have been done with different type of lineage, and if we focus on a mutator lineage that have a lot of mutations so that we can see what's going on, what we found out, if we compare the distribution of DCS scores among the mutation that are observed and the one you could get if you run them along the genome on all possible sites in the genome, you find that it's exactly the same distribution, which means that you sample the diversity of mutations that are possible around here. Okay. While if you look at the distribution of mutation that occur in nature, the impact on DCA compared to the one you could get by chance, you see a shift towards mutation that have much less of an effect. Okay, which means that this is predicting that, you know, natural selection is avoiding mutations that are predicted to be bad by DCA. Okay, and so we can use that. I mean, the power of that is about, it's as good, about as good as the power we have looking at synonymous, non-synonymous mutations. So we found that if we look at, you know, how much, what would explain, if I compare those two genomes, and I say, okay, what can explain the mutations when I look at coding sequences? And one of the dominant factor is, you know, whether mutations are synonymous or not. Because you find out, we all know that, you know, synonymous, you have less, more synonymous mutation than non-synonymous mutation. But then if we just look at non-synonymous mutations and we use that, we have also a very good prediction. Okay, so it means that we're trying to promote that we could use that, you know, as some test for molecular evolution. People are starting to do that more and more at SMBE. There was quite a bit of talk where people use Polyfen or SIFT prediction genome-wide to try to see whenever they have cohorts what's going on, the distribution of effects that have been selected in dog domestication or that. And we think that this is this could be used to go further.
So what is the good fit to the prediction then? I don't get it. So if you basically take the non-synonymous subfit.
So I'm trying, so the, what I'm doing, it's an, I cut it short because it's another talk, full talk. But the, what we did is that you have all the possible mutation in the genome. I have a file in which I have like all possible mutation in the genome. And then I compute all the possible statistics on those genes and mutations. So mutation is a, it's a synonymous mutation. It's a mutation of that type. The previous base is that, the next base is that. So I have a local background effect. Then I can look at the expression of the gene. I can look at the gene is essential or not. And I can look at the DCA predicted score of that mutation. And then I have a column saying, okay, do I observe this mutation or not in my among my two natural isolates? And I say, how can I explain this mutated or not with the previous variable? And one of the big factors explaining that is synonymous, non-synonymous, if you look in the wild. Okay, if you look at those natural isolates, it's of course you find that what is known, K over KS, is about, you know, 0.1. So you have 10 times more synonymous than what you would expect. And then with a great power, we found that you reject the, this explains quite a bit of the variance of the mutation. So you can predict that mutations that are really, you know, that are really strongly deleterious will not be observed according to those predictions. Okay?
That's pretty trivial.
I find this quite trivial.
I mean, it's not, yeah, it is, but it means that the tool is predicting, you have a tool to predict that your mutations are deleterious. Of course, it's trivial. I'm just saying, yeah, it's obvious that if you know whose mutation is deleterious, natural selection will filter them out.
It's a little bit more provocative if this tool just helps you to distinguish between synonymous and non-synonymous
mutations. No, because this is just on non-synonymous mutations, because these are non-synonymous mutations. When I just focus on the non-synonymous mutation, I have a score telling me those ones are highly deleterious and the other not.
Taking into consideration the background.
So that's one way that we can potentially, you know, add up, because all the molecular testing molecular evolution are based on synonymous, non-synonymous, but eventually we could, you know, implement some test based on this DCA score to try to predict also what's going on at a finer scale, just using this time non-synonymous mutations.
So if you go one step ahead and look at the degree of parallelism, where you basically find some things that are very parallel, what do you get there for those ones? They should be very, very positive.
When we look at just beneficial mutations, it's complex because in the wild and in the lab, you know, a lot of adaptation go through gene inactivation. So you find the distribution is also kind of has quite large variance, because some of the beneficial mutation inactivate function that in the wild would be under selection. So it's not, you know, when we look, it's not a way to, I would use it more to filter deleterious overall as a statistical stuff rather than to pick for the beneficial one. I would not use it necessarily. Eventually, an essential gene. Yeah.
Is zero meaningful here? Like, is that like neutral somehow, or?
Yeah, that's predicted to be a neutral. Yeah, according to that.
How much information do you need to have about the function or some kind of fitness effect of this protein in order for this to be useful?
So for now, it's just in an alignment of the protein that it has enough homologs and distant enough so that you can have some power to do that.
What kind of distance measurement is?
You need to have at least 300, 400, you know, homologs. Uh-huh. That are, of course, if they're whole human homologs from the 1,000 Genome Project, they're not, you know, they're not going to be that much information. So that I don't know exactly how much diversity you need, but you need quite a bit. You need it to support. It's not the. I mean, there's room for improvement because this is just one method based on that. You do not take into account phylogenetic relationship, so that's why you exclude usually sequences that are too similar. You give them a limited weight so that they're not too close. And so now with Martin and Olivier Rivoire, was another method to use that. We're trying to discuss how to improve those methods and take into account more and more stuff to be better. There's definitely room for improvement, but already from a start, you know, this method is giving, you know, better than, for instance, Polyphen 2, that is using single sites plus a lot of 3D structure information. So now we can also add eventually 3D structure information and so on and build on. But for now, for the science part, because this is more computer science than science to combine all information, but for the science part, we're trying to combine with more phylogenetic information, and we're discussing that. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Polymorphism data? So I don't know to what extent E. coli polymorphism data would be useful.
That's what I presented. That was polymorphism data.
I mean in natural populations.
That was in natural population. Not from the lab. No. That was the two main. We've done it also in the Lenski lineage and stuff like this. There's a paper coming out soon. But here, I just wanted to present that short. But I think it could be. I mean, it's, and I was. At SMB, it was interesting to see that there was a real move in that direction, not using that exact software. And there's another version that is sold by Debbie Marks, but it's actually the same one. But there's a need. You feel like there's a need for those kind of approach, because you could see that people were using SIFT, genome-wide, or other softwares that prepared to say, oh, look at the type of mutation we get. I said, yeah, there was a talk about dog domestication, or Brandon Goat talked about grape evolution. And you look at the patterns of mutation, you see whether they fit or not. And here it seems to be more powerful than the previous method. That's what we are.
Okay. Maybe we start at 11 or?
Yep.
prediction when you combine your two
experiments. I know.
So, what would you do when you combine one with a path where he's